Hello and welcome to this week's Inside Education, your weekly guide to education matters in Ireland and further afield. You can get in touch with me through Twitter at InsideEd, by email to insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie or through the programme's website insideed.com. If you're an educator with a story to tell or an event to highlight, please contact me and I'll do my best to feature it on a future programme. On this week's programme, I'm going to bring you the second part of my interview with Dr. Kevin Williams, who until recently was Senior Lecturer in Mater Dei Institute of Education. He's a former President of the Educational Studies Association of Ireland and a Research Fellow at the Irish Centre for Poetry Studies. Most of his work is in the philosophy of education and he's particularly interested in religion, secularism and citizenship, and he has published widely in these areas. On last week's programme, I spoke to Dr. Kevin Williams about junior cert reform and the work of teaching in general. On this week's programme, we discuss the topic of school ethos. I began this part of the interview by asking Kevin Williams if he thinks it's a good thing that religious education is taught in most Irish schools.
Yes, I do. I think that the educational experience of young people, if they don't study religion, will be impoverished. So I do think it's welcome and worthwhile. And for many reasons. One, religion is a possible source of meaning and purpose in life. And young people need to be alerted to the fact that like religion is a possible source of meaning and purpose in life. And that's, again, it's like sex education. They mightn't get it outside school. And that's a thing that's very troubling, that schools have responsibility to alert people to things they may not learn outside school. And I give you an example. At one time, in connection with research I was doing, in fact, for my book Faith in the Nation, I spoke to the principal of a school, a community school in a disadvantaged area, and I asked him if liturgies, now not just religious education, liturgies were compulsory. And he was a bit uncomfortable with the question, and he said, yes, but he said it's been quite a struggle because on the one hand, they don't want to make liturgies compulsory, particularly at senior cycle. Obviously, they're not compulsory for people whose parents take them out, and we're not talking about that, that's the law. And the constitution indeed. But he said that there was at one stage the pupils had insisted very much that liturgies be optional. And you know what happened? And the teachers went along with them, to their credit. A group of predominantly female pupils came to him and said they were being bullied out of going to prayer services and masses in the school, particularly by vociferous male students. And they said they wanted them to be made compulsory so that they could feel comfortable participating in these liturgies. And that's a really good example of listening to what the practitioners say, and like the practitioners listening to the pupils say, rather than listen to high theories. And anyway, the upshot of it, the liturgies are compulsory. However, he did say that they weren't policed very tightly. So I thought that was. I know people say that's an Irish solution to an Irish problem, but I thought it was a load of common sense and compromise, the sort of thing we want. And one of the reasons why he said he was glad that this was the final upshot of the situation was that he feared that young people weren't getting no exposure to religion. Many young people, he says, not some, many young people getting no exposure to religion in the community. And school was the only place where they kind of touched base with religion. And I think that's a reason for having religion in schools.
And how do you understand the idea of school ethos?
Have we got a whole day? Well, I suppose there would be the value priorities in a school. That's what I understand as school ethos, and the way these value priorities are lived out in the school's life. So, for instance, the value priority could be religion, it could be sport, it could be the Irish language. So the lived out value priorities in the school.
And do you think it's something that happens at a local level, or is it something that happens at the level of the system?
Well, it can happen at the level of a system, at the system in a sense, like in some schools, for instance, they might have a religious iconography, and that would be where it's the religious iconography is at the level of the system. But to have purchase in the lives of young people, it has to kind of take on life in the lives of the teachers as well. Like you go into a school which says it's concerned about the the whole person and all pupils of all abilities. And you see all around it photographs of the senior cup teams. But you're inclined to say that people who don't make the senior cup team are not very highly valued in this particular school. And it needn't be the senior cup team. It can be, like in a primary school, the Gaelic team as well. And
if we build on that idea, supposing you have a student who enters that school who is not at all sporty, and still the school has as its value priority that, you know, sport is valued here. To what extent should the ethos be changed, or should it be able to accommodate this student who comes in who has no interest in sport?
Well, I think there's, again, tradition. We turn to a tradition, and we've got great traditions in Irish education that the guff talkers don't even know about. They're in... First of all, there are many different kinds of sports, and in fairness, some of those schools that emphasise Gaelic and rugby do have other sports as well, although in their heart of hearts they may only care about the school Gaelic team or the school hurling team or the school rugby team. They do have other sports and activities. Like, take for example swimming. I think swimming is a great activity, and I know it's difficult for schools to organise swimming because few schools have swimming pools, but that's an example of an activity that can be open to all kids who are not the kind of competitive Gaelic footballers or rugby players. But let me give you a better example, Sean, that again many of your listeners may be unaware of. In the what were called the VECs, which are now called the Education and Training Boards, there has been a great tradition of what they called outward bound, and these were taking the kids on hikes, mountain walks, and scouting type activities were built into the school curriculum. I think that sort of activity is really good, and it's that kind of sporting activity is open to everyone, whether they're good footballers or not. And I think it's I've been told by teachers in the ETB sector that cutbacks have led to a reduction in the amount of outward bound they're able to offer young people. You just think of the value of outward bound, particularly for kids who come from disadvantaged areas. It brings them into nature. It gives them challenges, as we say, in hill walking and mountain walking. It gives them challenges in cooking in the outdoors. I think they're the sort of activities that need to be promoted, not just rugby.
And apart from the advantages, you say it's also very often used in anti-drug programs, that people get their highs from these activities, being out in the open air and hiking and abseiling and things like that. I know that you've looked at the idea of school ethos in other countries other than Ireland. What do you learn about the ethos in Irish schools from looking at the ethos in schools in other countries?
One of the things that is, I think, striking about Irish schools, if you're to look at the literature and even to look at TV programmes on school differences, is the emphasis on in Irish schools and in British schools in that care for the young people beyond the academic. And I think that that's one of the differences, we say, between schools here and schools in France or Italy. And there's a wonderful book called An Italian Education by the novelist Tim Parks. It's about his children growing up in Italy, and he's comparing Italian schools to the school he's experienced when he grew up in Manchester. And he says, my gosh, he says, the schools here just are concerned about the traditional subjects, and after that they're outside the school door and that's it. That's the way it is in Italy. In England there would be a much greater spread of after school activities and concern for the pupils outside schools. And there was a wonderful BBC programme about 10 years ago whereby people working in different jobs in European countries swapped places with people working in England. And the one about teaching was very revealing. A teacher from somewhere in the Bordeaux area of France came up to a school in the Oxford area, and she perceived the teaching in the Oxford school as being kind of unstructured and chaotic. I'll tell you what the thing that shocked her. The teacher, he was a very talented guy. He had set up the class in the form of a cafe. And it was a French class. Some of the pupils were waiters and some of them were diners, and they all had to speak French. The French teacher was absolutely puppet. You're not, they may be using wrong pronunciation. You're not able to check up on them all at the same time. And he said, well, at least they're getting into the language. And whereas when he went to the French school, he was struck by the emphasis on chorus responses, which he said had gone out 50 years ago in England. The other thing that she noted in England is when school was over, she said, oh, that's great, now let's go home. Oh, he said, I have to wait for a half an hour because I have to, the bus has to come and collect the children. But she said, surely that's not your responsibility. Oh, it is. They're my responsibility until they're off the premises. Now, I know that's an English, that's in an English school, but that would be the spirit here as well. Like, we have kind of accept responsibility for young people beyond just the classroom.
You've said you don't want to talk too much about the French system, but you did write an article where you talked about the idea of religious illiteracy. And what you seem to be getting at in the article was that students knew so little about the Christian heritage or the Christian tradition that it made it more difficult for them to learn about art and architecture and music and literature. Could you say a little bit about what you discovered there?
Well, I'm not the only one who discovered that. Like, the French themselves discovered that perhaps particularly at the start of this century, that there was a problem with religious illiteracy. And there's a story is told now. Maybe it's apocryphal, but it's the story which is kind of supposed to capture the spirit of the religious illiteracy of young people. A teacher takes her pupils to an art gallery, and there's a painting of the Madonna holding the baby Jesus. And a guy turns around to his teacher and he says, "Hey, miss, who's the bird with the baby?" And so that's referred to in loads and loads of the texts to communicate the religious illiteracy. This type of illiteracy came about from the fact that French teachers were afraid to mention they were not allowed to deal with anything to do with religion in school. And then, since the last 15 years or so, French educational authorities have realised that this has led to a kind of a cultural impoverishment, that they don't know enough about that aspect of their culture. And in fact, so deeply ingrained is this in France, and I've lectured a fair bit in France now, that teachers are scarified to refer to anything to do with religion. Obviously, we know it would be totally unacceptable even here for a teacher to go into and ask all kids if they'd been at Mass yesterday or what the gospel was yesterday. But this is something gone to another extreme, I think, altogether. The teachers try to avoid teaching the Reformation because it deals with religion. Teachers try to avoid teaching arguments for the existence of God because it deals with religion. And it's kind of fundamentalist and extreme and ultimately impoverishing.
So if I put a scenario to you, supposing a teacher is teaching in a school that has a particular religious ethos, say, and a child or a student asks that teacher a question, and if the teacher, whatever the question is, if the teacher is to answer it honestly, it contradicts or it goes against the ethos of the school. How does the teacher kind of maintain honesty and credibility with the student while also being faithful to the ethos of the school that they're working in?
Is this in Ireland now?
Yeah, in Ireland, yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, it can take a bit of careful negotiation. And teachers, well, are trained and educated to show that kind of discretion and sensitivity. Some do, some don't. A friend of mine came to me one time to complain that the teacher had said that parents who were divorced were living in sin, and that her daughter was really upset by this. Now, I think that's totally unacceptable. But I think it is. I think it is possible to answer these questions with a reasonable amount of honesty. But also to say, hold on here now, Sean, a second. If somebody says to a teacher, "What way are you going to vote on that referendum?" Well, a teacher can legitimately say, on the referendum on same-sex marriage, teacher can legitimately say, "I'm not going to share my politics with you. I'm a teacher." So I think, likewise, with a kind of an explicit question about, do you think sex before marriage is a sin? A teacher might say, well, the teaching of the Catholic Church is it is, but what do you think? Well, my own personal opinion is not an issue. But I think teachers have not all teachers, but they're, I'll give you two really good examples of where teachers have negotiated this tricky issue. A master's student told me that she was teaching in a boys' school in a disadvantaged area, and she was she was a religion teacher teaching the church's theology of marriage, and so she said the church's theology is basically one partner for life, and a guy says, "Ah, miss, that's a load of crap." And she says, "Well, why do you say that?" She says, "My ma has loads of partners, and she says it's great." And the teacher said, I thought really sensibly, said, "Look, the way our lives fall out is very different. And who am I to judge? And what the church is offering is an ideal." I saw something similar as well, where a teacher in a school of serious disadvantage was, again, found herself with that difficult topic of the Catholic Church's theology of marriage. She was told that the sex before marriage was absolute nonsense. Well, she said that, like, the church has reasons for its thinking on this and its theology on this, because it said it's only within marriage can people feel secure in their commitment to one another.
I think you meant the prohibition of sex before marriage. Yeah, that's fine.
And she said this is just not the church's thinking. Like many ordinary secular psychologists, she didn't use that terminology, but that what you would mean, would say, people need this type of shelter of commitment when they're engaging in sexual activity, because it protects them and it protects future children. That's the church's teaching on it, and but it's also rooted, she said, in good psychology.
Going back to when Rory Quinn was minister, and as you know, he talked a lot about divesting schools of patronage and of various types of patronage. But given your knowledge, and you did teach in a Catholic Institute of Education for a number of years, but supposing you had to pick an alternative worldview that would be the grounding ethos for a school that was compelling and credible, what would be available?
First of all, can I just say something about that thing about divesting? Like, I'm sympathetic towards it, but obviously many parents are not sympathetic towards it, because they're happy with the schools that they have. And I think this is very interesting as well. The way parents like the schools they have. I'm not saying all parents. Obviously, there are people who want different kind of schools. But people are satisfied. Generally speaking, there was a huge level of satisfaction came across in that survey with what people had. Right, that's number one. But what do I think should be the grounding ethos? Well, that's difficult in one sense, because we're not starting with a blank slate. We are where we are, and we have the kind of control of schools that we have now. So we have to negotiate around that now. But what I would, if I were the person with the authority, I would say we should have common schools. And that, I mean, I don't like this thing about we should have plural forms of patronage. I think we should have schools. Schools full stop. And schools which incorporate people who are believers, non-believers, believers of different kinds of religions. Not secular schools now, where you, like in France, where you mention religion at your peril and at risk of your job, mind you. Not secular schools. Educated Catholic schools can differ enormously, but some of them are going a bit in that direction, and some of them are very secular. And but I want common schools. Let's have schools. And I think perhaps all that stuff about patronage is nonsense. I'm a great admirer. We have vocation schools, ETB schools, which are schools. And I know they have boards of management which represent different interests, but they are state schools. And I think they've served the country marvellously well. And what I think is heartening as well is that these ETB schools, education and training board schools, are now available as community national schools at primary level as well. I think that's what we should have. Schools, full stop.
But what would be the ethos of the common school? Because you need something to guide it and to help teachers answer the big questions in life.
What would be the value priorities of a common school? Well, I suppose it would be hard to answer that question without descending into platitudes and cliches. The value priority of the school would be the maximal welfare of the young people within its charge. And I think that that's needn't go much further than that.
But when a child then asks a teacher, where did the world come from? Why are we here? What happens when you die? Isn't that where you need an ethos to be able to answer these big questions?
Yes and no. You don't have to be. You could. A teacher could legitimately say, "What was it? Who made the world?" Well,
Or what happens when you die?
Or what happens when you die?
Well, why do some people suffer?
Well, that's a really hard question. But we say, what happens when you die? Well, religious people believe and hope that there's an afterlife. That's a perfectly plain answer. It's not an answer that you're imposing on the children. You're just telling them what some people believe. And don't underestimate either, Sean, the extent to which in like the traditional, normally Catholic schools we have, that you have different voices. I was in a school one time supervising on teaching practice, and a rather naive young student teacher was in a primary school was teaching about the seven gifts of the Holy Spirit, and I must say I did find them a bit twee, and I said, how is he going to sell those to the kids, sixth class kids? But most of them were quite patient and about listening to it, but there were two of them who had very kind of unsatisfied faces, let's say, and they said, well, what do you think are, what are the last two gifts of the Holy Spirit? And one of them said, I don't think there are any gifts of the Holy Spirit. I don't think there's any Holy Spirit. And the little one beside her said, I don't think there's any Holy Spirit either. And the guy says, next you'll be saying there's no God. And the two kids said, yeah, we don't think there's any God. So like these were voices in a traditional Catholic school. And like teachers have been over the years negotiating around those voices as well.
You've written a book, Kevin, about the thinking of Michael Oakeshott. What drew you to his work?
Well, I suppose I had done my MA on the philosopher Gilbert Ryle, and I had written a thesis on Gilbert Ryle, and I didn't realise at the time in my innocence that I could have taken Ryle to a higher level for my PhD. I thought you had to sign a thing saying it had to be completely different. And I had... because Ryle, when I, as a student of philosophy, was my favourite philosopher. But as a student of philosophy of education, I had kind of come to resonate to the work of Michael Oakeshott, partly because he was so down to earth and he had such common sense, and he was so countercultural, and he didn't embrace the kind of windy platitudes and guff that were around. This kind of resonates with me because I'm a guy who's against guff. And then I discovered that as I pursued it a little bit more, I felt that he's a political philosopher primarily, and that in his political philosophy, which spills over obviously into his philosophy of education, there was an insufficient sensitivity to the condition of the very poor. And I said, what I want to do is show that respecting tradition and the richness of what we have inherited is really important, but a special sensitivity has to be shown to the very poor. That's number one. The other thing as well that I criticised in Oakeshott, I didn't feel that there was any emphasis on hand-eye practical activities, which I think are really important and enriching in education, and feature very little in the book on the new junior certificate. Like this kind of engagement with the world, with the soil, with touching, feeling and manipulating the world. I thought that was absent as well. And what I wanted to try and capture was, yes, we can respect tradition, but we have to acknowledge other aspects of human endeavour, and we have also to be aware, be particularly sensitive to where the impoverished of the earth find themselves. And another small little thing in Oakeshott, and I'm sure you've come across this as well, that really struck me. I'm a Gael Gore, as you may or may not know, but I think compulsory Irish has been the most daft policy ever. That Minister Quinn didn't mention with all his guff. He was afraid to take on the Irish lobby. And Michael Oakeshott said that the attempt to revive Irish in the Republic of Ireland was, he said, folly. And he said he put it up there with the great Marxist plans of the Soviet Union. And he says this is the, on a lower level, obviously, he says these are examples of daft political projects that are imposed on people, which are totally will never gain any purchase. So that was the thing as well. I said, wow, I said he he articulates what I feel about the Irish language and the attempt to revive it.
You've had a long career to date in education, and you know it's certainly not complete yet by any means, but from the work you've done to date, what are you most proud of?
Well, there are two things, Sean. In the first place, I'm proud, and I know it seems vain to say it, but I don't think I might never have an opportunity to say this again. I'm proud of having produced a body of work that student teachers and practitioners have found illuminating. And I trust that the work is sufficiently scholarly, and it's fine to have produced scholarship, but it's heartening to have produced scholarship that the people for whom it's designed find useful. That's the first thing that I'm proud of. The second thing I'm proud of is I've been fortunate enough to have a somewhat of a profile, a media profile with regard to education. And I'm proud of the fact that in spite of a lot of criticism, and my late mother used to tell me, said, stop drawing these people on you and stop drawing all this criticism on you. In spite of a lot of criticism in public fora, I have stood firm in indicting nonsense in newspapers and on TV and particularly on the radio. And I'm also proud of the fact, as well as having indicted nonsense, I have affirmed liberal values. Liberal values in two ways. Liberal values out of respect for freedom for young people. I have a great respect for young people's capacity to make decisions, and that liberal value I have affirmed in the public arena. And the second aspect, of course, of liberal values would be the values of traditional education rooted in the kind of forms of knowledge which are most sustaining for people. I've defended those as well, and I'm proud of that.
And what are your hopes for the future, Kevin?
I would hope that the voices of teachers and of the practitioners would be listened to and followed. As I said earlier, I love the teachers' associations, and I would listen to what teacher associations said, and I would listen very carefully to the voice of concerned and committed teachers.
I hope there from Dr. Kevin Williams that teachers' voices be taken more seriously in education. And that brings this week's Inside Education to a close. Thanks to my guest, Kevin Williams, for his time. If you'd like to feature an idea or an event on a future programme, you can write to insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. It's great to get your feedback anytime. You can listen to over 200 podcasts of previous programmes on insideed.com. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.